I'm Alan Stanford of Second Age Theatre Company, and welcome to Hamlet in Hoth.
To be or not to be, that is the question. To be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing enemies.
Like a desert opposing needs rain, like a town needs a name, I need your love.
Something is rotten in the state of Denmark.
Have you given him any hard words?
No, my good lord. But as you did command, I did repel his letters and denied his access to
that him. Hath made him mad. To die, to sleep no more.
I need your love.
To die, to sleep, to sleep, perchance, to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dream may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause.
A second time I feel my husband dead. When second husband kisses me in bed.
What a piece of work is man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and moving, how express and admirable in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of Adam. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me.
So here we are, program one of Hamlet in Hoth, and the title I'm giving to this program is Hamlet the Scholar, but I'm also giving it a subtitle of The Question of Good Parenting. Now, in spite of the very grandiose location of the play, it's set in Elsinore, the palace of a king. In spite of the cast of characters that includes kings, a queen, princes, lords, ladies, soldiers, sailors, pirates, and even actors, and a ghost. In spite of all of that, the play Hamlet is basically about the family problems of two dysfunctional families and the vexed question of revenge. Hamlet is a play about revenge. Now, revenge as a dramatic motif was very, very strong in the Jacobean period, in the period following the reign of Elizabeth, in the sort of the end period of Shakespeare's writing and the period that followed it. And you had a whole sequence of revenge tragedies being written, revenge being the major theme. It was a very strong and potent theme. It was almost, in modern sense, a sort of mafioso theme. Avenge my death would be the cry. And in this play, that's the central motivator of the action of the play. A father says to his son, avenge my death, and the son feels obliged to do it. What makes Shakespeare a genius is it isn't a father who says it to a son while going out or while dying in his arms. It's actually a ghost come back from purgatory that does it. So it raises a whole philosophical question as well. Is the ghost real? Is the ghost true? Is the ghost honest? Is it a trap? Hamlet is not an ordinary prince's son. Hamlet is a scholar. He's an intellect. He's a philosopher. So he doesn't merely react to those questions. He philosophizes about them. He discusses them internally. He questions his own motives. He does all the things that any modern person might do when given the proposition, avenge my death. Why? Why would I do that? Is it safe to do that? Is it a good plan to do that? Nobody ever just acts anymore. People react. People think about what they're going to do. They were doing it 450 years ago in the mind of Shakespeare as well. In Hamlet, in the play, the first thing we must discover is what must be revenged. And it is a twofold question. It is a death, but it is also a marriage. And the first thing we're going to examine is the question of that marriage.
Though yet of Hamlet, our dear brother's death, the memory be green, and that it us be fitted to bear our hearts in grief and our whole kingdom to be contracted in one brow of woe. Yet so far hath discretion fought with nature that we with wisest sorrow think on him, together with remembrance of ourselves. Therefore, sometimes sister, now our queen, the imperial jointress to this warlike state, have we, as 'twere, with a defeated joy, with an auspicious and a dropping eye, with mirth and funeral, and with dirge and marriage, in equal scale weighing delight and dull, taken to wife.
And that was Peter Robinson from St. Fintan's High School, who was reading Claudius for us. Now, there we also have the first problem. Not Peter, but Claudius. Claudius has married his brother's wife, which religion teaches is adultery. According to law and church, a man may not marry his brother's wife because she is his sister in law. And you can't marry your sister. So, Gertrude, Hamlet's mother, seems to have agreed rather quickly to this marriage. Within a couple of months, she has married him. Now, we must ask a question here. Hamlet lives in Denmark, a country surrounded by enemies, one of whom was Fortinbras, king of Norway, who had invaded and had been defeated by Hamlet's father, old King Hamlet. Young Prince Fortinbras is threatening to attack Denmark. Denmark loses its king at a time when it's under attack. The heir to the throne is a student in Wittenberg, hundreds of miles away. But sitting there in Denmark is a very astute political leader, the king's brother. And it is an elective monarchy. In other words, you don't inherit the throne by right because you were the king's son. The nation has to agree that you are, not the nation, because the ordinary peasants don't get a vote in this sort of thing, but all the lords, all the barons, everybody else agree you're going to be king. And they elect Claudius as king. Gertrude marries him because they want to make sure that everything is tight. Everything is agreed. Everything is cut and dried. She has a choice. You can become the Dowager Queen living in a cottage, or you can stay queen of the country and live in the palace. I know which I'd choose. Not to be queen, but I'd certainly choose to stay in the palace. Now, so that's the situation we're in. A country under threat of attack. They elect quickly a good political leader, Claudius, to be king. Hamlet is sort of left on one side. Hamlet doesn't really... He's not really so fussed about the fact that he's not been made king. He's fussed about the fact that his mother has married his uncle very, very quickly. He's not looking at it from a political perspective. He's looking at it from a family, from a personal perspective. He resents it deeply. Now, before we turn to the moping Hamlet, all still dressed in black, when the rest of the court has put off its mourning because there has been a wedding, Hamlet is still deliberately and very politically wearing black in mourning for his father. Claudius, before addressing Hamlet, because it is a difficult problem, first of all in the court of that day decides to address the question of the Polonius family and deals with Laertes first.
And now, Laertes, what's the news with you? You told us of some suit. What is't, Laertes? You cannot speak of reason to the Dane and lose your voice. What wouldst thou beg, Laertes? That shall not be my offer, not thy asking.
My dread lord, your leave and favour to return to France, from whence thou willingly I came to Denmark to show my duty in your coronation. Yet now, I must confess, that duty done, my thoughts and wishes bend again toward France, and bow them to your gracious leave and pardon.
Have you your father's leave? What says Polonius?
He hath, my lord, wrung from me my slow leave by laboursome petition, and at last upon his will I sealed my hard consent. I do beseech you, give him leave to go.
Take thy Ferrara, Laertes. Time be thine, and thy best graces spend it at thy will.
And that was Tomás Quinagon, Sam Clark, and Daniel Fallon reading the roles of Claudius, Laertes, and Polonius. Now, it's an interesting observation on Claudius there, how clever he is. He wins everybody over. He's the perfect politician. He's the kind of guy going around saying, you will give me your number one, won't you? He embraces people with words. And now, Laertes, what's the suit with you? You told us of some suit. What is it? You cannot speak of reason to the Dane. He is the Dane. You cannot speak of reason to the Dane and lose your voice. Whatever you want, tell me what you want. See if I can help you out on this. He is everybody's friend. He's a very clever, astute guy. He's a smooth operator. So that Laertes suddenly is elevated in importance. This is a very important point for later in the play. Laertes feels that Claudius is on his side. Polonius says, he's wrung from me my slow leave. Polonius says, I don't want him to go. I'm not happy about him going. But if he insists on going, I suppose I'll have to let him go. Whereas Claudius is saying, off you go, enjoy yourself. You're young, have a great time in Paris. I was there when I was alive. It's that kind of attitude. So what Shakespeare is doing is demonstrating Claudius as a consummate and political operator. Now, having dealt with that, he turns to Hamlet and tries to deal with him. But again, he will begin this conversation with an incredibly clever and politic line.
But now, my cousin Hamlet and my son.
A very, very clever line to start with. But now, my cousin Hamlet and my son. Any member of the royal family would be addressed as cousin. It's one of the things they do. If you are directly related to the monarch, you address the monarch as cousin, and the monarch addresses you as cousin. So that's not unique, but he follows it with another line. And my son. To call Hamlet son is formally declaring that the question of succession, in other words, he's saying, I may be the king, but you'll be the next king after me. Don't worry about it. But he's also saying, you are now my son. The question of the marriage, of your father's death, is now over. I am married to your mother. You are now my son. So he begins the conversation almost by ending it.
A little more than kin and less than kind.
Now, Hamlet responds almost with a sort of a wry joke. A little more than kin and less than kind. What he's saying is, yes, I'm a little bit more than just your cousin. I'm the actual heir to the throne. And a little bit, I'm not true son. I'm little less than kind. I'm not your type. I'm not your son. I'm not like you. So what he does, Claudius opens the arms with this big and formal gesture, and Hamlet says, not a hope. Go away. Not interested.
How is it that the clouds still hang on you?
Not so, my lord. I'm too much of the sun.
Good Hamlet, cast thy nighted colour off and let thine eye look like a friend on Denmark.
Now there's another interesting development. Shakespeare's taking us step by step into the complexity of this family. Hamlet again makes a little joke. Not so, my lord, I am too much in the sun. Claudius says, why are you all the clouds of misery hanging on you? He's saying, no, there's no clouds, I'm in the sun. I am too much in the sun. In fact, I am the son of the last king. Remember that. Gertrude, the mother, now steps in. Good Hamlet, cast thy nighted colour off. Stop wearing black. And let thine eye look like a friend on Denmark. Now, it's very important to note this line, and I mentioned it earlier, that when she refers to Denmark, Gertrude is not referring to the country, but to the king. Claudius is Denmark. He's referred to as Denmark. He refers to himself as Denmark or the Dane. Just as later in the play, Claudius will refer to England. It is not the country he refers to, but the king. When Claudius says, do it, England, he's telling the king to kill Hamlet, not the country. But let's go back to Gertrude.
Do not forever with thy veiled lids seek for thy noble father in the dust. Thou knowest 'tis common, all that lives must die, passing through nature to eternity.
Aye, madam, 'tis common.
If it be, why seem so particular with thee?
Seems, madam. Nay, it is. I know not seems. 'Tis not alone my inky cloak, good mother, nor customary suits of solemn black, nor windy suspiration of forced breath, no, nor the fruitful river in the eye, nor the dejected haviour of the visage, together with all forms, moods, shapes of grief, that can note me truly, these indeed seem, for they are actions that a man might play. But I have that within which passeth show, these but the trappings and the suits of woe.
He really lets her have it. He put right between the eyes, he said, seems. I'm not pretending to be in mourning. I am in mourning. What I feel inside is real, genuine grief. I have that within which passes show or demonstration. These are just the trappings and the suits of woe. These are just the clothes of grief. Inside, I am crying. What Hamlet is saying to his mother and Claudius, that he has gone far beyond official mourning. This mourning is eternal, deep, and true.
'Tis sweet and commendable in your nature, Hamlet, to give these mourning duties to your father. But you must know, your father lost a father. That father lost his, and the survivor bound in filial obligation for some term to do obsequious sorrow, but to persever in obstinate condolement is a course of impious stubbornness, 'tis unmanly grief.
And here Claudius appeals to Hamlet's manhood. He says, come on, be a man, face up to it. Your father died, his father died. But to keep mourning on about it, you're not manly, it's girlish. Forgive me, ladies, but it is. Also remember that when Claudius says, your father lost a father, he's also referring to his own father, because Claudius and Hamlet's father were brothers. So what Claudius is also saying is, I've been here too. My father died, but we get on with life.
We pray you, throw to earth this unprevailing woe, and think of us as of a father. For let the world take note, you are the most immediate to our throne, and with no less nobility of love than that which dearest father bears his son, do I impart toward you.
And here Claudius very clearly states that Hamlet will be his son and heir. In other words, he's repeating that same motif. He's saying, I am now your father. Think of me as a father. You're my son. You're going to be my heir. Forget your own father. That's gone. Let's deal with what's happening now. Let's face up to life. Let's take it on the chin. Be my son.
For your intent in going back to school in Wittenberg, it is most retrograde to our desire, and we beseech you, bend you to remain here in the cheer and comfort of our eye, our chiefest courtier, cousin, and our son.
Let not thy mother lose her prayers, Hamlet. I pray thee, stay with us, go not to Wittenberg.
I shall now my best obey you, madam.
Not Claudius, you'll note. He's very deliberately saying to his mother, I'm obeying you. You don't want me to go back to university, I'll stay here. Tiny little bit about school at Wittenberg. There's huge debate constantly about how old is Hamlet. The gravedigger later on in the play actually gives Hamlet's age very clearly as 30. So you sort of say, well, what's a 30-year-old doing going to school in Wittenberg? But we must remember Wittenberg was a major university, and Hamlet may have been there as a scholar rather than as a student. In other words, he could have been there for a long time. He could be teaching. Wittenberg also, by the way, was the place where Martin Luther, the father of Protestantism, was also in school. But that's another story. We won't go into that now. The fact is, Hamlet could be much younger at this point in the play. He could be 18, 20. There is the potential for time gaps in the play that Shakespeare's never very specific about. But the time that Hamlet is in exile could be much longer than merely a week or two. There are moments in the play where time could pass. I'm personally of the belief that the play starts with Hamlet at the age of 30 and ends with Hamlet at the age of 30. But that's a personal preference. That's something for you to work out for yourselves. But before we move on, a word of thanks to Aisling Murphy, Declan Mulligan, and Aina Ryan for reading those sequences.
I'm Paul Kerrigan, and I'm from Publiscull Nassau. This is my favourite line from the play. It's from Act 5, Scene 2, and it's one of Hamlet's lines. Not a whit. We defy augury. There's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. Since no man knows aught of what he leaves, what is it to leave betimes? Let be. I like the piece because it aptly shows the transformation between the brooding, misanthropic Hamlet presented earlier in the play into the driven, powerful character he is in the final act, willing to die for his revenge against Claudius.
Hi, I'm Sarah Milan, and I'm from Santa Sabina Dominican College in Sutton. It's kind of strange, but Claudius is probably my favourite character in the play. He's probably the strongest character, and he's a very clever man. He's able to continue his duties even though he has guilt. Even though he doesn't have a lot of guilt, he still has that little bit of guilt we see when he's praying. He's a very modern politician as well. He's able to spin stories, and he knows that when Polonius dies, he has to grasp it before the rumours and stories spread. So he sets down a meeting with his councillors to kind of set the story straight. He is a despicable character in the sense that he killed his own brother to steal the crown from him, but he is probably the most interesting character to watch develop. So I think that's probably why my favourite character is Claudius.
Hello, my name is Emmett Duffy. I'm a fifth year in St. Finton's High School in Sutton. Another thing I like about Claudius, although thought to be a mildew ear without honour, he tries to repent his sins by praying to God for forgiveness. This little fate saves him, as Hamlet decides he cannot kill him while he prays, or else he will go to heaven. Unfortunately for Claudius, like all great villains, he gets what's coming to him. He is slain by our hero Hamlet, stabbed, then poisoned, and dying a very dramatic death. The villainous qualities of Claudius are why I like him so much.
You're listening to Hamlet in Hoth with me, Alan Stanford of Second Age Theatre Company. Hamlet is left alone, and he begins the first of the great soliloquies. Now, these are very important moments in the play. They are moments when Hamlet actually talks direct to the audience. On Shakespeare's stage, he would probably have walked right to the front of the stage and started talking to the audience on a very intimate level. And what he's doing is, in the soliloquies, he's explaining his dilemmas, he's explaining his problems to the audience, and he's, in a way, sort of seeking their understanding, as if he was saying, I've got a big problem here and I need to talk about it to someone. I don't want advice, I just need to talk it out. Which, again, is something that we can probably recognize in ourselves. Sometimes we don't want to hear advice, we just want somebody to listen to us. And that's exactly what Hamlet does with these soliloquies. And the first one happens at this moment when he's left alone, when he's realized that whatever he may feel, whatever he may think, his father is dead, his mother has married, somebody else is on the throne, and nobody really cares that much about him.
Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew, or that the everlasting had not fixed his canon gained self-slaughter. Oh, God, God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fie on it, ah, fie, 'tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely.
And here we hear basically Hamlet's statement of despair. He tells us just how low he feels. We can recognize it. Oh, God, God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable. It all, everything stinks, basically. Which I think just about everyone listening would recognize at some point in their lives.
That it should come to this. But 2 months dead, nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king, that was to this, Hyperion to a satyr, so loving to my mother that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth, must I remember? Why, she would hang on him, as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on, and yet within a month, let me not think on it, frailty, thy name is woman.
And here he tells us, by the way, of his father for the first time. It's the first time he refers in that sense to his father. Not as a soldier, not as a king, but as a loving husband. A husband that Gertrude adored. She would hang upon him as if increase of appetite had grown by what she fed on. In other words, the more she was with him, the more she seemed to love him. He also starts this process of reduction. But 2 months dead. Nay, not so much. Not two. That'll get changed again in before the speech is over.
A little month, or ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body, like Niobe, all tears, why she, even she, O God, a beast, that wants discourse of reason, would have mourned longer, married with my uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules.
And here he speaks of the utter disgust he feels about the marriage. But you notice that 2 months, nay, not so much, not two, has now become one little month. As the play progresses, it'll come down to a few days. But it is that sense of it's just so unfair, it's so unfair. It was only yesterday, like. And also, that wonderful notion, before the shoes that she went to the funeral in had grown old, she bought them for the funeral, and here she is a month later at her own wedding. There's something seriously wrong here. The family is, as far as he's concerned, completely dysfunctional. Nobody cares about his opinions. And there we have Peter Robinson, Sam Clark, and Connor Duffy, three excellent Hamlets from St. Fintan's High School.
My name is Naomi Matavu and I'm from Malahide Community School. My favourite character in the play is Gertrude. Gertrude plays a very passive part in the play's action. She emerges as a weak and somewhat shallow woman. She seemed to love the king. According to Hamlet, she would hang on him. Yet, according to the ghost of the king, she was unfaithful to him, even while he was still alive. Gertrude is more of a confused/naive character. She doesn't see what's around her, neither does she sense the hatred around. She has just married Claudius, the brother of her dead husband, within a month of his funeral, and she doesn't realize that, of course, her son Hamlet is going to somewhat look at her in disgust. Instead, she wishes that Hamlet would make peace with Claudius. Gertrude is in fact totally submissive to the wishes of Claudius and appears to be always in his shadow. In my opinion, Gertrude is, how shall I put it, morally blind. However, as morally blind and insensitive as she may be, Gertrude is shocked to learn that her husband was murdered. I love the way she is so naive. She doesn't realize how Claudius is just twisting her around his index finger.
I am very glad to see you. Good even, sir. But what, in faith, make you from Wittenberg?
My lord, I came to see your father's funeral.
I pray thee, do not mock me, fellow student. I think it was to see my mother's wedding.
Indeed, my lord, it followed hard upon.
Thrift, thrift, Horatio. The funeral baked meats did coldly furnish forth the marriage tables. Would I had met my dearest foe in heaven, or ever I had seen that day, Horatio.
Hamlet is talking to probably his closest friend. Horatio is somebody who is from, not from Elsinore, not from Denmark, not, or possibly from Denmark, but not from the world of Hamlet's family. Horatio comes from the world of Hamlet's life outside of Denmark, from Wittenberg, from the university, a fellow student, a fellow scholar, and certainly a fellow philosopher, but most importantly, a good friend. Horatio hardly speaks to anybody else in the play other than Hamlet, the odd word here and there, but most of the time he only speaks to Hamlet. And Hamlet trusts Horatio completely. It's a very important bond in the play that Hamlet has one person that he can trust. Horatio has turned up probably for the funeral, although Hamlet does make the joke that you're actually here for the wedding, and it was done very quickly so they could use the same caterers. It's a joke on Hamlet's part, and it just shows that warmth that there is between the two characters. Now, at the very opening of the play, Shakespeare showed us something quite otherworldly. He does that in a few of the plays. He does it in Macbeth and he does it in Hamlet. In Macbeth, he provides us with a set of witches, and in Hamlet, he provides us with a ghost. The question is it real? Was it what they think it was? It could be an hallucination. It could be a demon. It could be many things. But they are fairly convinced that it's the ghost of Hamlet's father. And who are the first people they come to talk to it about? Hamlet himself.
My father, methinks I see my father.
Where, my lord?
In my mind's eye, Horatio.
I saw him once. He was a goodly king.
He was a man. Take him for all in all. I shall not look upon his like again.
My lord, I think I saw him yesternight.
Saw? Who?
My lord, the king your father.
The king my father?
Now, Horatio knows that this piece of news of the ghost is absolutely fantastic. I mean, it is so out of anything that they might consider possible. But the fact that it's Horatio saying it, I mean, Hamlet as a scholar normally would just say, that's nonsense, there's no such thing as ghosts. But Horatio is saying it, and Hamlet takes the bait.
But where was this?
My lord, upon the platform where we watched.
Did you not speak to it?
My lord, I did, but answer made it none.
'Tis very strange. Hold you the watch tonight?
We do, my lord.
Armed, you say?
Armed, my lord.
From top to toe?
My lord, from head to foot.
Then saw you not his face?
Oh, yes, my lord. He wore his beaver up.
What? Looked he frowningly?
A countenance more in sorrow than in anger.
Pale or red?
Nay, very pale.
And fixed his eyes upon you?
Most constantly.
I would, had I been there.
It would have much amazed you.
Very like, very like. His beard was grizzled, now.
It was, as I've seen it in his life, a sabre silvered.
Now, you'll notice through this, Hamlet is testing them. He keeps questioning. He keeps, was he pale or was he red? Very pale. And he fixed his eyes on you. He wasn't sort of sliding his eyes all over the place. Absolutely, constantly. His beard was grizzled. No, it wasn't. It was sable, it was beautifully smooth, and it was silver. It wasn't dirty, grey, grizzly thing. So what Hamlet is doing is saying, was it my father? Was it my father? And he's testing them with each question. Did he look like my father? And the answer each time is, yes.
I will watch tonight. Perchance 'twill walk again.
I warrant it will.
If it assume my noble father's person, I'll speak to it. Though hell itself should gape and bid me hold my peace.
Hamlet has now been completely hooked. Whatever this thing is, it certainly seems to be his father, and he's got to find out. And that'll be his next task. And thank you to Sam Clark, to Connor Duffy, to Dan Fallon, and to Emmett Duffy for that splendid rendition.
Hi, my name is Greg Keegan, and I'm teaching in St. Fintan's High School in Sutton. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to look at a previous title from the past exam papers. The appeal of Shakespeare's Hamlet lies primarily in the complex nature of the play's central character, Hamlet. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and to give people an idea of the type of things that we could say. It's easy to admire a noble character, and it's admirable to emulate a moral character, but it's fun to like a flawed character. Human beings are by our very nature flawed. Literary characters that negate our fundamental being are not appealing. We sneer at these characters that live in a perfect world and live by perfect moral codes. Hamlet is a character who is flawed in many regards. His behaviour is undesirable, his morality is hypocritical, and his sense of loyalty is corrupt. This complex play has appealed to audiences for over 500 years. Hamlet, traditionally seen as a noble mind that has fallen from grace, and to some today seen as a flawed and corrupt character. Either way, it is obvious that his personal complexity is central to the enduring appeal of the play. Most of the moral questions raised in the play can be found in the role imposed on Hamlet by the ghost. Revenge, his foul and most unnatural murder. The role of the Avenger is presented against a strong Christian background. This is, however, a contradiction in itself, as murder is hardly a Christian attitude. Once again, the character's morals are brought into question. The world of Hamlet is a Christian one. The ghost returns from purgatory. Ophelia does not receive proper funeral rites due to her supposed suicide. Claudius believes in the redemptive qualities of prayer, and Hamlet obviously believes in heaven and hell. It's against this Christian moral background that we must examine Hamlet's sense of right and wrong, and by doing so, his obvious complexity greatly adds to our enjoyment of the play. If Hamlet accepts his role as an avenger in the manner of his first impulse, haste me to note that I, with wings as swift as meditation or the thoughts of love, may sweep to my revenge. Then he would be committing an act of regicide and murder. Effectively, he would be acting against the moral values that he claims to uphold. It could be argued that it is these values that stay the hand of Hamlet, but it is, in an ironic twist to his complex character, the very same values that lead to the most brutal of all Hamlet's moral atrocities, his decision to wait till Claudius is not in an obvious state of grace before he kills him. Up, sword, and know thou more horrid hent, when he is drunk, asleep, or in his rage. This is probably the most morally corrupt decision of the whole play. If Hamlet did not possess a Christian sense of right and wrong, the fact that Claudius is in a state of grace would bear no relevance. The fact that it does bear relevance, and that it does prevent him from taking his revenge, is not only ironic, but also cruel and callous. It is this complex and disturbing side of Hamlet that surfaces on more than one occasion during the play, that adds to the overall appeal of the play. The point remains that it is his complexity that makes the play so appealing, not the fact that this character is so noble and angelic that flights of angel sing thee to thy rest.
Now, I did mention there were two dysfunctional families in this play. The other is the family of Polonius. And as we know, because Claudius has given leave, Laertes is about to set sail back to France. But before he goes, he has some advice for his sister concerning Hamlet. And this is the kind of advice I imagine any brother would give to his younger sister concerning a potential boyfriend.
For Hamlet and the trifling of his favour, hold it in a fashion and a toy in blood. A violet in the youth of primary nature, forward, not permanent, sweet, not lasting, the perfume and suppliance of a minute, no more.
No more but so?
Think it no more. Perhaps he loves you now, but you must fear, his greatness weighed, his will is not his own, for he himself is subject to his birth. He may not, as unvalued persons do, carve for himself, for on his choice depends the safety and the health of this whole state, and therefore must his choice be circumscribed unto the voice and yielding of that body, whereof he is the head.
You can actually hear the brother talking to the sister. Perhaps he loves your life. Maybe he does, but it's only a fancy. It doesn't mean he's going to love you forever. And anyway, he can't marry you. He's saying clearly, he hasn't the choice. He's a prince. He will have to marry a princess. His marriage will be political. He'll be aligned to some other country. That's happened all over Europe for 2,000 years, that a prince married a princess from another country because it was a political alliance. That's how kingdoms developed. So what Laertes is saying is quite true. Hamlet hasn't, because he's a prince, The one thing he can't do is what he wants. He may want to marry you, but he won't be allowed to marry you. So whatever you do, don't do something that might mean you have to marry him. Be careful.
Fear it, Ophelia, fear it, my dear sister, and keep you in the rear of your affection. Out of the shot and danger of desire, the chariot maid is prodigal enough if she unmask her beauty to the moon.
Out of the shot and danger of desire. In other words, what he's saying is, whatever you might fancy, don't do it. And I'd like to thank Paul Harkin and Lucy Sweeney for reading Laertes and Ophelia. Now, as I've said before, Polonius falls quite a long way short of being a good parent. He's far too much of a politician for that. We live in the household of Polonius as very much a male-dominated environment. There is no mention of a Mrs. Polonius. There's no mother in there. We assume that she must be dead. So it is a male society, and it's full of male principles and male-dominated ideas, and very political ideas. As I say, Polonius may not be a good father, but he's a very astute politician, and he does give some very good advice to his son before he leaves for France.
Give thy thoughts no tongue, nor any unproportioned thought his act. Be thou familiar, but by no means vulgar. Those friends thou hast, and their adoption tried, grapple them to thy soul with hoops of steel, but do not dull thy palm with entertainment of each new hatched, unfledged comrade. Beware of entrance to a quarrel, but being in, bear it that the opposed may beware of thee.
It's good advice. He's saying, have friends, but make sure they actually are friends before you start spending any money on them and trusting them too much. And if you do get into a row, make sure you come out of it acquitting yourself like a man.
Give every man thy ear, but few thy voice. Take each man's censure, but reserve thy judgment. Costly thy habit as thy purse can buy, but not expressed in fancy. Rich, not gaudy. For the apparel oft proclaims the man.
And there's another very sound piece of advice. Listen to people, don't talk too much. Listen to criticism, but don't give it too much. Look like a gentleman, look like the gentleman you are, but don't look like an idiot. Don't follow fashion, follow style. Because, as he says, the apparel oft proclaims the man. If you look like an idiot, people will tend to think that you're an idiot.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be. For loan oft loses both itself and friend, and borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry. This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow, as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man.
To thine own self be true. Very, very good advice. And if only Polonius had followed it himself, instead of being the creature of Claudius, true to Claudius rather than to his own judgment, he might have survived the play alive. But Laertes is now on his way.
Farewell, Ophelia, and remember well what I have said to you.
'Tis in my memory locked, and you yourself shall keep the key of it.
Unfortunately for Ophelia, Polonius overhears that remark. And thank you to Jake Grogan, to Lucy Sweeney, and to Daniel Murphy for that reading. As I say, Polonius, very sharp, very political, and he's onto that little exchange like a swooping hawk. Anything concerning his daughter's behavior, and more importantly, virtue, is very important to him. A daughter is a commodity, and if a daughter gets spoilt, she can't be sold. So Polonius immediately questions Ophelia.
What is, Ophelia, be hath said to you?
So please you, something touching the Lord Hamlet.
Marry well be taught. 'Tis told me he hath very oft of late given private time to you, and you yourself have of your audience been most free and bounteous. What is between you? Give me up the truth.
He hath, my lord, of late made many tenders of his affection to me.
Affection? Pwah! You speak like a green girl unsifted in such perilous circumstance. Do you believe his tenders, as you call them?
I don't know, my lord, what I should think.
Marry, I'll teach you. Think yourself a baby, that you have ta'en these tenders for true pay, which are not sterling. Tender yourself more dearly, or, not to crack the wind of poor phrase, running it thus, you'll tender me a fool.
The very important point is that Polonius, he loves words, and he loves word play, and you'll find out later on, as we move through the play, he indulges almost in constant word games with himself, But you'll notice the way he plays on the word tender. Ophelia says that, that Hamlet has of late made many tenders of his affection. Tenders as in offers or suggestions of his affection. And Polonius plays on that word. Think yourself a baby that you've tamed these tenders for true pay, these offers of love for real love, which are not sterling, they're not real. Tender yourself more dearly. Look after yourself. Tender, offer yourself at a much higher price. Or not to crack the wind of a poor phrase running it thus, you'll tender me a fool. In other words, he is saying, Ophelia, Hamlet is only interested in you for one thing, and you mustn't let him have it, because if you do, I'll end up with a fool. And in this sense, the fool is an illegitimate child.
My lord, he hath importuned me with love in honourable fashion, and hath given countenance to his speech, my lord, with almost all the holy vows of heaven.
Aye, Springs, to catch woodcocks. I do know when the blood burns how prodigal the soul lends the tongue's vows.
It's an interesting thing that Polonius says that, because he's saying, yeah, he's making all the holy vows of heaven, but they're just a trick. It's just a trick to get you to do what he wants. I know what it's like. He's almost confessing to the fact that when he was young, that's exactly the kind of thing he would have done. Bit of a confession there.
From this time, be somewhat scanter of your maiden presence. Set your entreatments at a higher rate than a command to parley. For Lord Hamlet believes so much in him that he is young, and with larger tether may he walk than may be given you.
And what he's saying again here is Hamlet is young, but he is a prince, and he's a man, and he's freer to do things because he's a prince and a man. You are not. You are a girl, and you are young, and you cannot have the freedom that he has.
This is for all. I would not in plain terms from this time forth have you slander any moment's leisure. As to give words or talk with Lord Hamlet, look to it, I charge you, come your ways.
And this is Polonius's first great error. Because in cutting off the friendship and the possible love between Hamlet and Ophelia, he makes her a subject of Hamlet's suspicion. And he starts a process that will eventually lead to both their deaths. And thank you to Jake Grogan and Aveen Killeen for reading Polonius and Ophelia. Hamlet is now on the battlements. Now he's going to find out whether it's true or not. Is it a ghost? Is it a demon? Is it his father? The night is wild. The night is cold. Claudius is partying in the castle, the way Claudius is generally partying in the castle, and generally drinking as well, a comment that Hamlet makes about him. But out here, we have a man alone wanting to greet his dead father. And the dead father arrives. And in this section, Hamlet we read by Aina Ryan and the ghost by Declan Mulligan.
Angels and ministers of grace defend us. Be thou a spirit of health or goblin damned. Bring the airs from heaven or blast from hell. Be thou intense, wicked or charitable. Thou comest in such a questionable shape that I will speak to thee. I call thee Hamlet, king, father, royal Dane, oh, answer me.
And again, there is a note of caution with which Hamlet greets the ghost. He needs to be certain of the truth of its identity. He wants to know, are you really what I think you are? Please be what I think you are. But he also does address it as king, father, and again, that important phrase, royal Dane.
Mark me.
I will.
My hour is almost come. When I to the sulphurous and tormenting flames must render up myself.
Alas, poor ghost.
I am thy father's spirit. Doomed for a certain term to walk the nights, and for the day confined to fast and fires, till the foul crimes done in my days of nature are burnt and purged away. List, list, oh list. If thou didst ever thy dear father love.
Oh God.
Revenge his foul and most unnatural murder.
Murder?
Murder most foul. As in the best it is, but this most foul, strange, and unnatural.
And here we have it. We might call it the avenge my death syndrome. This is the moment when the plot of the play really gets established. Avenge my death. I am your father's spirit. The ghost says it. It's unequivocal. There's no doubt. I am your father's spirit, and I want you to revenge the foul and most unnatural murder done on me. This is a terrible moment. It is saying to somebody, to anyone of you listening, go out and kill somebody. If you love me, kill that person. It's a great motif in drama. It's a great motif in Shakespeare. It happens all the way through the plays, the tragedies, the histories, and even the comedies. There's a wonderful moment in Much Ado About Nothing, which is one of his greatest comedies, where one character turns to another and says, "Kill Claudio," and she means it. The injunction to kill another human being is terrible, because you are redirecting an innocent life down the path of revenge. And this exists in all societies, not just in drama, in societies, in all nations. It's there from the plays of Jacobean England to even films like, you know, The Godfather. As I say, it's like a mafioso play. Revenge is one of the great motivators in drama and is one of the great motivators in life and death. It drives forwards heroes and villains alike, and it destroys lives. And that's the point that Shakespeare wants to make. The Ghost doesn't merely say, "Revenge my murder," but to make it more poignant, to make it, to actually grind it into Hamlet's imagination, he goes into the gruesome details of how that murder happened.
"Sleeping within my orchard, my custom always of the afternoon, upon my secure hour thy uncle stole with juices of cursed hebanon in a vial, and in the porches of my ear did pour the leprous distillment, whose effect holds such an enmity with the blood of man that swift as quicksilver it courses through the natural gates and alleys of the body, and with a sudden vigour doth posset and curd like eager droppings into milk the thin and wholesome blood, so did it mine. And a most instant tetter barked about, most lazard-like with vile and loathsome crust, all my smooth body. Thus was I, sleeping by my brother's hand, of life, of crown, of queen at once dispatched, cut off even in the blossoms of my sin, unhouseled, disappointed, unannealed, no reckoning made, but sent to my account with all my imperfections on my head."
How gruesome is it? He keeps explaining those awful details, the words he uses, the leprous distillment that's swift as quicksilver, as mercury, shot through the blood, shot through his body. Did posset and curd, that idea of everything congealing inside of you. With most instant tetter barked about, most lazar-like, with vile and loathsome crust. So what the Ghost is doing, he's saying, he didn't just kill me, he made my body disintegrate. But not only that, the Ghost takes it one step further, and this is the important step, because we must remember the religious basis within this play, because it's going to cause certain things to happen. "Thus was I of crown of queen at once dispatched, cut off even in the blossoms of my sin, unhouseled, disappointed, unannealed, no reckoning made, but sent to my account with all my imperfections on my head." In other words, he killed me before I had a chance to confess. I did not die in a state of grace. I died in a state of sin. And because of that, my soul did not go up. It went down to purgatory. So he's putting into Hamlet's mind not only the hideousness of the physical murder, but the fact that he went very close to murdering old Hamlet's soul as well. He is now in purgatory and he must suffer there, which is more than Hamlet could ever forgive. The Ghost's final injunction to Hamlet is that he wants to be remembered. Not to lie forgotten in death, but to be remembered and to be revenged.
"Remember thee, oy, thou poor ghost, while memory holds a seat in this distracted globe, remember thee. Yea, from the table of my memory, I'll wipe away all trivial fond records, all souls of books, all forms, all pressures past, that youth and observation copied there. And thy commandant all alone shall live, within the book and volume of my brain, unmixed with baser matter. Yes, by heaven, O most pernicious woman, O villain, villain, smiling, damned villain. This time is out of joint, O cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right."
But he must set it right. No other consideration in his life now matters more. Nothing, not friends, not lovers, not mother, not father, no consideration now matters more than he set right what has been done to his father. He must now go on a journey. Most of Shakespeare's heroes have to go on a journey, and Hamlet's is a very strange journey. From Hamlet the scholar that we've now seen, through Hamlet the clown, and even into Hamlet the exile, before he can have his revenge as King Hamlet, as he proclaims himself, Hamlet the Dane. And now we come to our quiz, and our quiz is divided into four rounds of four questions each. The first will be an audio round with individual answers. The second will be an individual question to each of the contestants, and the third and fourth rounds will be on the buzzer. There's 2 points for each correct answer. 1 point if I think you nearly got there, and if I think you only nearly got there but not very well, I might pass the point over to somebody else. Our four contestants are Sarah Malone from Santa Sabina Dominican College in Sutton. We have Glenn Stevenson from Pobolskol Nason in Baldoyle. We have Sam Clark, who is from St. Fintan's High School in Sutton. And finally, we have Owen Gallagher, who is from Skull Irsa in Malahide. Now, here we go. First round is an audio round. The first question goes to Sarah. I want you to tell me what the missing word is.
Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a d-
What's the missing word?
I
have to pass it over. Anybody else guess? Sam?
Dew.
A dew. Thaw and resolve itself into a dew. We'll give you 1 point. Glenn, have a listen to this.
My offence is rank. It smells to heaven.
Who's speaking?
Claudius?
Claudius, correct. 2 points. Now, Sam, your turn.
Your bait of falsehood take this carp of truth, and thus do we of wisdom and of reach with windlasses and with assays of bias. By indirections, find directions out.
Who said that?
Polonius.
Polonius is correct. Well done. 2 points for Sam. And finally, Owen, we come to you.
A second time I kill my husband dead. When second husband kisses me in bed.
Who's saying that line?
One of the players.
Which one?
The queen.
The player queen says that line. So that's 2 points for Owen. We move on to round two. Let's have a little bit of applause. <for that one. laughs> Okay, second round. Now, these are direct questions to each of you. And we start with you, Sarah. Elsinore... What country is Elsinore in?
Denmark.
Well done, 2 points. Glenn, who is the Queen of Denmark?
I'm sorry, don't know.
You don't know who the Queen of Denmark is. Pass it over, anybody? No. Sam got his hand up first.
Gertrude.
Gertrude is the Queen of Denmark. Nice try. 1 point there for Sam. And Sam?
I thought you meant the current Queen.
The current Queen of Denmark. Since the quiz is about Hamlet, I think we can reasonably suppose that that's what they're referring to. But on that basis, I'm going to give you a point for being clever, and I'm going to give Sam a point for getting it right. Okay, Sam, your question. Of whom is Hamlet speaking when he says, he was a man, take him for all in all, I shall not look upon his like again?
Yorick?
No. Anybody? Glenn.
Hamlet the First?
Hamlet the First, his father, the ghost, yes. Now, moving on. Owen. What is the name of the play within a play in Hamlet, and I'll accept one of two titles?
The Mousetrap.
The Mousetrap is correct. 2 points. For no points at all, does anybody remember the other title of the play? Yes.
The Murder of Gonzago.
The Murder of Gonzago. Well done. May not know the Queen of Denmark, but he knows his titles. Round the third. Now, this is where the buzzers come into play, we hope. And again, don't buzz till I finish the question. Who says, to thine own self be true? And it's Glenn.
Polonius.
Correct. Who says, be wary then, best safety lies in fear, and to whom is it said? Glenn?
Laertes to Ophelia.
Very good. Two more to Glenn. You see? What is different about the character of Yorick? A... Is he from Sweden? B, is he an animal? Or C, is he dead? That was Owen.
He's dead.
Yes, well done. Who says something is rotten in the state of Denmark? That was Sam.
Hamlet.
What?
Hamlet, no.
Not Hamlet, no. Glenn.
Marcellus.
Marcellus. Very good indeed. Final round, buzzers again. I think Sarah is not getting as quick onto the buzzer as she would like. Get that finger poised. What is the phrase in Hamlet that means to be injured by something you intended to injure others? Is it A, to suffer the slings of arrows of outrageous fortune, B, to fall into a watch, then to a weakness, or C, to be hoist by your own petard? Complex question. I'll repeat the question. To be injured by something you intended to injure others. Glenn.
To be hoist by your own petard.
That's very good indeed. To be blown up by your own bomb, basically. Very good indeed. How did Ophelia die? Owen.
Drowned.
She drowned. Well done. Who says the rest is silence? Oh, come. Sarah.
Hamlet.
Hamlet. Yes, well done. I strongly suspect that was a guess, but we won't go there. And the last question of the quiz. Who says, and to whom, think yourself a baby that you've tamed these tenders for true pay, which are not sterling? Sarah.
Polonius to Ophelia.
Well done. 2 points. So after our scrutineers have spent an awfully long time adding up ones and twos, I can now tell you that in fourth place, but with a valiant effort, was Sam at St. Fintan's. And in third place, with a very, very impressive last-minute surge, came Sarah from Santa Sabina.
Sweet.
In second place, with a steady but not necessarily complete knowledge of the play, was Owen from Skull Isa. But in first place, with a remarkable score, was Glenn from Pubble Skull Nasson. That was Hamlet in Hoth. Our thanks to the staff and students of Pubble Skull Nasson, Val Doyle, Skull Irsa, Malahide, St. Fintan's in Sutton, and our host school, Santa Sabina Dominican College, also in Sutton. The production team was Sarah Blake, Nicolene Greer, Eddie O'Halloran, Pat Hogan, Charlie Norton Sherwood, Kevin Brew, and Kevin Reynolds. I'm Alan Stanford from Second Age Theatre Company. Until next week, goodbye.